Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government?
Welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, the Rebel Madman, Mike Gaddy. Mike, say hello, brother.
Hello, brother.
Well, I think we better open this show with a prayer. I certainly don't want to forget that tonight because, boy, we need a lot of prayer in this federation or socialist republic. What are we calling it now anyway, Mike?
A conglomeration.
Yeah, you got that right. It's an ugly conglomeration. Let's pray. Almighty Father in heaven, we're just come before you in awe of your majesty and your creation. And it just puzzles us how we as humans can mess it up so bad. And Father, we need you so much in our life. We need your son. The thoughts that we think these days, we probably really need his blood to cover us with his righteousness because, boy, I think we're all probably having trouble not sinning today. Father, we just we pray for your spirit to be with us, to guide us, to lead us. We want to be in your desire. We want to be catching the wave that you are creating. We know that ultimately you are in control and you are the ultimate victor in all of this that's going on, the spiritual battle that is raging right now. You knew it was coming. You prophesied about it. You've made a lot of promises to us, and it's those promises that we hold on to and is really our only real hope in this life today. And Father, we are thankful that you're there and we could come to you and that we can rely upon you, and you are the one stable, solid thing we can depend upon. So fill us with your spirit. Watch over us in this show tonight. Take control of everything we say and do. And watch over the people in this United States, because and the whole globe, really, all of those that are in your book of life. Father, watch over them, because we see execution already happening, but we also know that it's promised that it's going to come, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, Father. And we trust in you. We rely upon you. It's in the name of your Son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, there's awful lot of talk out there, and I'll tell you, it's really difficult to hang your hat on anything today, and we've heard so much about 1871 lately, more from people that probably didn't even know what had happened in 1871, but they've now figured out that the Reconstruction era was not a good thing for us and that we've been paying the price for it ever since. And I know you want to go back before 1871 to kind of set this up, but bring us a good history lesson tonight, Mike. We all need it.
Well, thanks, Terry. One of the things, you know, that I, in studying, especially the founding era, because I think if you want to find out what's wrong with the government today, I think you find it in the roots, you know, because today we're witnessing the fruit of what was planted in 1787, in my opinion. And you have to get a full understanding of the characters who were involved in writing, creating the Constitution of 1787. And you and I have discussed, I'm not sure if we've discussed it on this show before, but we've discussed the Committee of Style, haven't we?
Yes.
Well, the
Mr.
Committee
Morris.
Of Style, right, the Constitution, the Committee of the Whole at the Constitutional Convention in late August of 1787, they finished a rough draft of the Constitution that they wanted, and then they sent the rough draft to a Committee of Style and Arrangement, and it was staffed totally by Federalists. There was not an anti-Federalist on the group anywhere. And so then what happens is cases, and there's even a paper before the U.S. Supreme Court now on this. Gouverneur Morris was the penman of the Committee of Style, and he changed. He actually put some things that had been voted down in the Committee of the Whole, he put them back in the Constitution on his own volition. He changed the wording. He completely and totally changed the wording of the preamble. And I think we might find some of the work in there that leads us to the 1871 that we're talking about. And so the thing that was especially telling about the Constitution, and we all use the words "we the people." You know, it's been used probably more than any phrase when it comes to government in the United States. Oh, it's "we the people." Well, you know, the crazy thing about it is "we the people" didn't have anything to do with writing that document. It was a group of what Alexander Hamilton referred to as the wealthy aristocracy. They wrote that. They prepared that document in America. There were no common folks there. So it was we the people. But there is a special meaning to that, because look at the preamble to the Constitution. And Gouverneur Morris wrote, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, provide," you know, all of the stuff there. And he says, "We the people of the United States." And then go to the end of it. "Do ordain and establish this for the people of the United States of America." There's two different entities listed there. We the people of the United States and the United States of America. Two separate entities. Gouverneur Morris was not an idiot. He was a brilliant scheming psychopath in many ways, sociopath at least. So together, just absolutely brilliant. So there are two separate entities mentioned in the preamble. So then go later into 28 U.S.C. 3002 15A, and you will find out that the United States is a corporation. But, you know, we talk about, you know, well, I've heard people say, well, you know, they only meant, you know, that 10 square miles in Washington, D.C., when they wrote the Constitution. Folks, they hadn't even decided on Washington, D.C. as the capital for the country when the Constitution was written. It was not, you know, so you can't say, hey, that this is what they meant, was the 10 square miles around Washington, D.C., because we didn't even settle on the D.C. area, what we now call Washington, D.C., which was a swamp in Virginia at the time. We hadn't even considered that. The first Congress was in session, and the Assumption Act, which Hamilton was trying to get passed, had not been successful. And so he encounters Jefferson on the street in New York, and he's telling him, he's lamenting the fact that he just can't seem to get this assumption bill in. And so Jefferson agrees to have dinner with Hamilton and Madison. And Jefferson and Madison agree to support the Assumption Act. And Hamilton's the one who made the offer. He said, look, what if I get behind a bill and get my people in Congress to support moving the capital to Virginia. to the Virginia area. And so Madison and Jefferson agreed to support the Assumption Act if that would be the trade-off, and they could move the capital there. So they agreed to do that, but then they moved the capital from New York to Philadelphia for a set number of years, and then it was finally moved to D.C. So D.C. wasn't even thought of when the Constitution was drafted in 1787 and ratified in 1788. Wasn't even mentioned. But Gouverneur Morris set up a difference there. He set up a corporation. Now, of course, USC 3215A was not 28 USC 3215A was not written until later to make it a corporation. But they intended, Hamilton and his group intended for it to be a corporation from the very beginning. That was why the separation in the preamble to the Constitution. So any thoughts on that, Terry?
No, that's pretty pretty clear.
Well, of course, then we get to 1871, and we have to stop and think about what the people in the South had endured there for about 5 or 6 years at that time. And this was, you know, about midway through Reconstruction. And the South had been totally stripped of any representatives in the Congress. So they were ruled by a government that they had no representation in whatsoever. And why did we say we started the Revolutionary War? No taxation without representation. But the Reconstruction Right. Act of 1867, which would be 4 years, you know, before 1871, the Reconstruction Act divided 10 southern states into 5 military districts and put a Union general in charge of each one of those districts. And so the military conducted the elections. They did everything was in the hands of the military. It was a military dictatorship in the South, and it created all kinds of problems.
Now, I kind of want to make sure that we got the proper context for this situation. When was the war between the states over?
Well, technically April 9th, 1865 at Appomattox, but Shelby didn't surrender in Texas until sometime after that. And of course, part of the deal at Appomattox between Lee and Grant was that Lee would recommend to the Congress, because Grant actually asked Lee, said, well, if he gave him the terms of surrender, and Lee said, yes, he said, I find your terms very generous. So Grant says, well, then if you sign this, you're signing it for the entire Confederacy, and you would have to contact the other armies and tell them to surrender. And Lee told Grant, that's not in my power, sir. That would reside with our president and our Congress. And Grant very facetiously said, well, you don't have a president anymore. We've only got one president in this country. So anyway, the dialogue that took place, which was recorded, that's where that came from. But Lee was right. He could not surrender for the other branches of the army. So later, the other branches, including Joe Shelby, would surrender in Texas, which would be the last one to surrender. And that was
We're looking at 5 to 6 years after that. What was the makeup of the Congress or the legislature for that time period?
Well, for that time period, there were no Southerners represented in Congress. See, that's what led to when they first put when the war was over, they brought Southern representatives in long enough to ratify the 13th Amendment, which the Southern states did. And then they threw the 14th Amendment at them, and the Southern states said, "Not no, but hell no, we're not signing that 14th Amendment." And so then the Reconstruction Act of 1867 comes along, and they kick the 10 Southern states out. They couldn't kick Tennessee out. The president was from Tennessee, and that would have been a real logistical nightmare to have a president from outside the country. So they couldn't kick Tennessee out, so they kicked the other 10 states out and then divided them up into 5 military districts. But the South had no representation. And the first representation that was sent to the Congress, there could be no one could be elected to office initially who had given aid and comfort to the South. And there were so many conditions on aid and comfort. Basically, if you had lived in the South, you gave
now,
aid
right,
and comfort
right
to the
before
South.
Right before Lincoln was assassinated, he had witnessed something that caused him to want to immediately reseat the South. Can you just mention that real quick?
Yes. After Richmond surrendered and Jefferson Davis and Judah P. Benjamin and several others left Richmond and started South, after Richmond surrendered, Lincoln wanted to go to Richmond and see Richmond. And he was there under heavy military escort, but he was just appalled at what he saw in Richmond. There were kids who were emaciated and had been starved and all of the things that had gone through the war. They couldn't find food. And, and looking at these small children, with no food and what have you. And he even mentioned in his own diary that he saw little children chasing rats trying to get something to eat. And it really seemed to have really affected Lincoln quite a bit. When he got back to the White House, there was a band traveling through the area celebrating the surrender. And they go to the White House. The band goes to the White House, and they ask Abraham Lincoln, who was out on the balcony, they said, "What song would you like to hear, Mr. President?" And he said, "Play Dixie." Well, that may have been his death knell. Others who had financed this war had no intention of bringing the South back in as full representatives, because they intended to financially rape the South, which they did through Reconstruction. So, when Johnny Horton, a country music star, did a song about that, it's called Johnny Reb. And he accurately said that, Lincoln said, "Let's play Dixie for Johnny Reb and for all that he believed." And then shortly after that, Lincoln's dead.
Yep. And he was assassinated in what year?
1865.
So again, 1871, we're talking 5 or 6 years after Lincoln was assassinated and the war was over. Go ahead.
Well, it began to be, again, what happened is, ironically, one of the funny things I was discussing it with my friend Jennifer today, was that the Republicans in Congress, what they call the radical Republicans, it was not a unified front in the Congress at the time at all. I mean, the Democrats had stood up in Congress and had stood up against the radical Republicans and what they were trying to do, and had tried their best, especially Senator John Baird from Delaware. He was he gave a 3-day speech called Executive Usurpation, where he talked about the things that had happened. And then there was a Congressman Voorhees from Indiana, I believe it was, and he made one heck of a speech about what was happening to the South, what was being done to them. And that was so they could not, and the Republicans knew if they were to retain power, they could not allow the South to have representatives, because if you brought back those 10 states, immediately you brought back 20 senators. And they knew that they would never hold power if they allowed that to happen. And so they refused to seat, which is a violation of the Constitution, because no state shall be deprived of its senators, which is actually written into the Constitution in that wording. But they did it anyway, and then it was vetoed by Andrew Johnson, And Johnson was supporting the Constitution and mentioned the Constitution, said, we can't do this. And he said, there hasn't been such a terrible move against any number of people, and I'm paraphrasing, hasn't been anything done against the American, any people, not American people, in any people on the planet in the last 500 years. He said this was totally egregious. So the Congress in 1865, 1866 tried to impeach Andrew Johnson for following the Constitution. I realize that sounds kind of crazy with all the impeachment talk that we're having today and what we've already endured. And we go back and look at the other impeachment, you know, like of William Jefferson Clinton. But they actually tried to impeach Andrew Johnson. And the bill of impeachment against Andrew Johnson was for removing Ulysses Grant as Secretary of War. And they said that he could be impeached, that he wasn't entitled to remove or add to his cabinet unless Congress approved of it. And we know that that's been done constantly throughout the years. But they were really upset with Andrew Johnson because he kept vetoing everything that they were trying to do with Reconstruction. But unfortunately, with no Southerners in the Congress at all, the radical Republicans were able to, overrule every veto that he established.
So what was what was going on then that prompted them to do the Act of 1871?
Oh, Kerry, that is a whole bucket of worms there. Let me see. I was trying to look at some of my notes. Can give you a more detailed thought on that.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry. Hold on one second. If you want to chat about something, let me get my notes. I just erased them. I got to recover them. Go ahead and chat about something until I can find him again, please, sir.
Go right ahead. I've got a little chat going on with someone online, and they made a comment about Grant sold us out, stripped power away from the American voter and the original Constitution. At that point, the original Constitution had been pretty well stomped on. People don't realize how much Lincoln actually stepped on the original Constitution. He actually ordered the entire state of Virginia to surrender their arms. And you talk about a violation of the Second Amendment. And this was before the Civil War, as you may call it. We call it the War of Northern Aggression, or the Law of Northern Aggression. And before it got started, Lincoln actually ordered the entire state of Virginia to surrender their arms. How can you have a more egregious violation of the Constitution than that? And by the way, this Constitution that we perceive as being our organic Constitution was not our original Constitution. Our original Constitution was the Articles of Confederation. And when they had the convention in Philadelphia in 1787, in fact, they changed and altered the ratification process and what was required for the ratification. And therefore, this Constitution is unconstitutional because it did not meet the requirements of amending the previous Constitution. So we've got a lot that we really need to correct in our history classes. Our history books are teaching our kids a lot of things that are false. And that's really the beauty of a gentleman like Mike Gaddy, because he brings out source documents. He's looking for notes right now because I know that when he talks about history, he's constantly referring to source documents. He's not just giving you an opinion of what went on. He's actually showing you what went on. Mike, are you ready?
Well, I haven't quite found those notes. I hit the wrong button with my thumb here, my big fat thumb. I will recover them as we're going along. It'll just take me a few minutes. But just to elaborate on what you said, Terry, the point's very well made, was that of the delegates sent to Philadelphia in 1787, the delegates who were sent there, none of them were sent there to create a new constitution. That was not in their not in their authority. None of it was in their authority. As a matter of fact, two delegates from New York, Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr., left the Constitutional Convention, wrote a letter to the governor of New York, George Clinton at the time, and they stipulated in their letter, we cannot stay here, because to stay at this convention would be to violate the authority and to exceed the authority that we were given by the people of the state of New York. Because they are creating an entirely new constitution, and we were not given the authority to participate in that. And you may say, well, what did these two guys know? Well, here was the thing. Both Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. were members of the Supreme Court in the state of New York at the time. And in 1789, Robert Yates would become the Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court. They very eloquently said, hey, you can't do this. Here is the point, and most people can't understand this, is that until that Constitution of 1787 was ratified by nine states, which happened in June of 1788, until that happened, the governing document was the Articles of Confederation. And so when they went to the Constitutional Convention, they were violating the laws that they were supposed to be adhering to. And I know that's hard for most people to understand, but they were violating the law. Go ahead.
The question has been asked, where can I find the organic Constitution? I know that some of those documents were actually burned up in 1812?
1812.
When the White House was torched?
Yes. 1812.
So you can still find copies of that in other places, I do believe. Where have you found it, Mike?
Well, I found it in the National Archives.
Okay.
And it's actually there. You can, of course, you can't see the original. I mean, you can see it when they bring it out of the vault. You can see it under a huge plexiglass containment. You can actually see it, but you can, at that time, when I was looking at it in the 80s, you could look at it on microfiche, and you could actually get copies of that, like mine are stamped with the Library of Congress seal. And, you know, they put the seal on there and it says original, a copy of an original, not for resale. And I can understand why they did that, because when I would get copies, they all say not for resale, because they didn't want people coming in and turning that into a commercial enterprise, getting original copies and then selling them and putting them into what have you and selling them to the people. So
I understand that there are some libraries in some cities, capitals of states, that have copies of a copy of an original.
Yeah, you can find them in several collections. The University of Virginia has them in their archives as well. You can actually access some of the older documents at the University of Virginia archives. You can access those for, you know, a subscription of something like $800 a year or something. If you want to go that bad, but I really think what is happening throughout the country is these original documents. You know, we've talked about Samuel Brine's, and we've talked about some of these other documents and the prices of some of these books. You know, you get a 144-page book of Samuel Brine's Essays of Sentinel on Amazon right now. It's $930. 144 pages, $930. That it's what we're having is censorship by money, because people just aren't going to pay that to get a 144-page book. And the access to these source documents, like I said, it's University of Virginia. You know, you can, yeah, you can access their files all you want to for about $800 a year. And how many people are going to do that? You know, it's a very small minority. So what you're doing is you're keeping the truth away from the majority of the American public. And that's by design. My opinion. I sell it for what it's worth.
Are you having any luck with your notes?
No, I haven't found those.
Or
yet,
did
Terry.
I distract you?
It's just my, you know, I can't believe I hit that button. Now I got to find out where they went. I apologize for that. So if you want to branch into something for a minute and give me a few more minutes to see if I can find them, because I've got some original documents I would like to read from.
Well, one of the reasons that we're talking about 1871 tonight is because of all of the internet chatter, if you will, from people who act like they really have a handle on what's really going on. They believe that there's going to be a military solution and that we're going to have our original republic restored, because they believe that in 1871, because of the act of 1871, that the United States was incorporated, and in fact that corporation was owned and controlled by foreign entities. And so this is a major thing. I know that the source documents that Mike has found from back at the time of this Constitution that we perceive to be our first Constitution that was supposedly ordained by God. At that time, there was already indications that there were corporations and that the United States was in fact incorporated back then. So I'm anxious to hear Mike's take on exactly what prompted the Act of 1871 and how it changed the structure. I know that they changed the Constitution because they did add all caps. They did change the word for to of. And people seem to think that that was of major significance. And I'm hoping Mike can cast some enlightenment on that for us. And Mike, I'm not sure what else I should talk about, because anything else would be off topic.
All right. Well, let me go. I found some of my notes. I didn't find them all, but I found this. And so of the Act of 1871 on Chapter 62, and that's how it's annotated, it says an act to provide a government for the District of Columbia. And I'm reading from the source document now. It says, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that all that part of the territory of the United States included within the limits of the District of Columbia be, and the name is hereby created into a government, and the same is hereby created into a government by the name of the District of Columbia, by which name it is hereby constituted a body corporate for municipal purposes and may contract and be contracted with, sue and be sued, plead and be impleaded, have a seal and exercise all other powers of a municipal corporation not inconsistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States and the provisions of this act. So in that part right there, they are saying that whatever the District of Columbia does, it's like the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, Article 6, Clause 2. It must be in pursuance of the Constitution, whatever is conducted within Washington, D.C. So that's a restrictive that they try to avoid. But Section 2 says, and be it further enacted that the executive power and authority in and over said District of Columbia shall be vested in a governor who shall be appointed by the president by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, and who shall hold his office for 4 years and until his successor shall be appointed and qualified. The governor shall be a citizen of and shall be resided within said district 12 months before his appointment and have the qualifications of an elector. He may grant pardons and respites for offenses against the laws of said district enacted by the legislative assembly, thereof. He shall commission all officers who shall be elected or appointed to the office under the laws of the said district enacted as aforesaid, and shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And Section 3, and be it further enacted that every bill which shall have passed the Council and House of Delegates shall, before it becomes a law, be presented to the governor of the District of Columbia. If he approve, he shall sign it, but if not, he shall return it with his objections to the House in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it. Now, Terry, I am at a loss as to where people think they're going to take this thing and overturn the government with it. I just don't understand. And I realize the sentiments that are running rampant in this country. Everybody is looking for a straw to turn around the debacle that happened in November. And I've heard, and I was on radio today, for an hour, and I heard, you know, some things that that I don't know. I was talking today, and the gentleman said, "Well, you know, the military could take over, and the military could do this, and the military could do that." That is totally unconstitutional. But what amazes me is people are, and this is why we're in this mess. People are more than willing to break the Constitution if it does what they want it to. Understand how people who say they're on the political right can advocate the destruction of a Constitution because the other side, they claim, destroyed the Constitution. So what we're headed for here is utter chaos. Eventually, I think it's on the way anyway, my opinion. Again, I sell it for what it's worth. But I do not see... Where do you see, Terry, or in your research, that people think they're going to use this to somehow recover what they want in government?
Well, I think they're looking kind of at the wrong place. I know there are things that happened at that time period, not the Act of 1871, like they're pointing to, but the whole Reconstruction situation did change things. But like you've always pointed out, it really goes back to that unconstitutional constitution that we've been dealing with in 1787 because of the loopholes that the Federalists stuck in there regarding the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause, and by removing the word expressly out of the 10th Amendment, they set it up so that, as Lysander Spooner has said, that whether the Constitution be one thing or another, it either authorized what we have today, or it was unable, and I forget the exact verbiage, but in essence it said unable to prevent it. And he was
right.
Exactly correct. I also read the Act of 1871 several times, actually, before today, some years ago and more recently. And I heard the same thing when you just read it, when basically they were setting up a home rule situation with D.C. and having the administration of it appointed by the federal government, by the executive branch. I recognize that they played games with that original Constitution. I don't believe this was it. I don't think that making this go away is going to change the jurisdiction problems that we have with Washington, D.C. People have entered into contracts. We've had all sorts of things subsequent, you know, the bluff of the 16th Amendment, putting the IRS out there, making people believe that the progressive direct unapportioned income tax is now somehow constitutional, which it's not, never has been. Supreme Court said so in 1896. We're looking at, like you said, they're looking for straws. Can the military step in here and take control? Maybe. Will it be constitutional? Probably not. I'm just puzzled by all of this, and it makes it difficult. You know, people look to me, and I know to you, as like we have some kind of crystal ball, and we can tell them exactly what's going to happen. And I'm just sorry to say that we're not going to know till it happens, but we've got to be ready. We've got to be prepared. That's enough for me to get off my soapbox and let you get back into the history lesson.
Well, Terry, one of the things that concerns me is these people who are hoping the military takes over, which is just one of the most asinine things I think anyone could ever hope for. Nowhere in recorded history of man has the military taking over a country ever turned out to be anything good. That has never, ever happened. George Washington was totally against it because we had the Newburgh Conspiracy. Most people have never heard of that, but the revolutionary officers under George Washington formed a group which was called the Order of the Cincinnati, and they sought to overthrow the government, and Washington stopped them, much to his credit. Again, said, no, we can't have a military rule of a country. It's never been good. It will not be good. And the last time we had the military rule in the country was Reconstruction. And how anyone can look at Reconstruction and think that's a good thing, and think that they would want the same thing again, let's bring in the military and put them over each state. And people are willing to do that. Yes, sir.
Mike, let's look at this for a second. It's my understanding, and I heard this all the way back in 2016, that Trump had 200 generals behind him. And I don't question the fact that some of these white hat generals came to him and were talking about pulling a military coup if Hillary got in, and that they would forestall that if Trump would run, and they would help him get in there. I don't really question that. I believe that happened. But there's, 653 or so generals in our military, and even if he still has 200, it's still only one-third of the military generals or less that he has in support of him, backing him up. I question how he's going to take control of the whole military when we've got a lot of generals who are leftist. And, you know, this is not new. Lincoln's generals were Marxist, and most of them weren't even U.S. citizens, for goodness sake. So how all of a sudden could we rely on the fact that the military would do what they say? And the talk is that they're going to show that the election was a fraud. They're going to present the evidence for that, and then they're going to invite the real winner of the election back in. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, I don't know where in the Constitution it says the military can invite somebody to be president. I've yet to find that, and I've read it a few times. I can't find anything in the Constitution that says that. The other thing is, I don't think people have a full grasp. People right now would this is the thing about desperation. People on the right are feeling desperate, and they will try anything. And you know what happens when you try anything? When you get into that desperation deal and you say, oh, you grasp at anything to try to get something to work. And people are willing now to just destroy the Constitution they claim they stand for if it will just put the man they want in as president. And they don't care how it's done. And the bejesus out of me, that people have gotten to the point that they're willing to throw everything to the wind that they claim they stand for if it will just get the desired result for them. that has led to more catastrophes in the history of this planet than anything else, is that utter frustration to get something done. I mean, stop and think. Under the Constitution, Terry, Constitution in full effect, 1860, Abraham Lincoln is not even on the ballot in 10 southern states. Abraham Lincoln gets less than 40% of the popular vote, and he's still elected president. Now, how, and under the Constitution, that was allowed to happen. Claimed that was an unconstitutional election, because it was not.
Mike.
So, yes, sir.
I agree with the comment that I'm reading in this chat that I've got online. The people spoke and were ignored. Is there a constitutional remedy available at this juncture to correct the crime that has been committed, this treason that has been committed by the banksters, through the Democrat Party, and through the voting irregularities, to put it mildly? Is
under
there
the
a constitutional remedy at this juncture?
Under the Constitution, absolutely not, and it was planned that way by the founders. They left so many gaping holes in this Constitution that so many good people to block, like Luther Martin, Robert Yates, John Lansing Jr., Mercer, John Mercer, so many people tried to, George Mason, Elbridge Gerry, so many people tried to put the fail-safes into this Constitution that would have prevented exactly what we have right now, but the Federalists voted it down. The Federalists
so
didn't
we're,
want
we've really
all of these
got to, we've really got to look back at the Declaration of Independence.
To correct? Me, Terry, the Declaration of Independence is the organic document of this country. To me, that's what established this country. Now, if you will notice, the courts have made it very plain that the Declaration of Independence has no legal standing. Now, what should that tell you about the American judiciary? It has no legal standing. Why would they say it has no legal standing? Because they know that the Constitution is contrary to the Declaration of Independence. And it was designed to be that way. So what is happening today is this thing, which was rotten in the roots in 1787, has now produced the full bloom of socialism. And there is nothing constitutional that you can do to repair that. You know, they tried the courts. How'd that work? You know, and right now, again, what we're seeing is just total desperation. And people are going, oh, just think, how do we get back to this? But for years, you know, people, I totally agree with Thomas Jefferson. You get the government you deserve. And for years, everyone has thrown away any constitutional restraints when they vote. When has there ever been a constitutional, a presidential election in my lifetime where any candidate was asked constitutional questions? They're asked political questions. People can't ask the constitutional questions because they didn't know enough to ask the constitutional question. But they were content to have a popularity contest, or they voted against somebody. Okay, well, I don't like that person. I'm voting for this one for president because it is the lesser of two evils. So we have finally accomplished it. Go ahead.
Is there anything in the Articles of Confederation that would provide a remedy?
Oh, yes. There's all kind of remedies in the Articles of Confederation. That's why the Federalists wanted to get away from them. And they had to get rid of those limitations. They did not want their powers to be expressly delegated. They didn't want to be confined to any limits whatsoever in that Constitution. And if you look at the first Congress and look at the Bill of Rights, when they were trying to bring in the Bill of Rights, they neutered the Bill of Rights to make sure that the people could not hold them responsible. Patrick Henry spoke of it extensively, that there is no responsibility. You have no way to force this government to do what it's supposed to do. And they were conveniently left out. That was intentional. It was not an accident. James Madison, to argue on three different occasions with Thomas Tudor Tucker of South Carolina, no, we're not going to put expressly delegated into the 10th Amendment. We're not going to confine Congress. James Madison said it himself. We can't confine Congress to expressly delegated powers. We have to allow them rights by implication. Well, people, you have rights by implication today. Implied powers is exactly what you're living under, because those powers are not listed in the Constitution. I don't know how better to say it, Terry.
Well, we've I think we're at a point in this discussion that we need to change our thinking. We need to be talking about potential solutions without violence. Of course, it can always come to that, but right now we need to seek other intelligent solutions to try to find a nonviolent solution. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, Terry. And we talked about this on the program I was on today. And someone asked me, he said, well, what is your... I said, we are not going to progress anywhere as long as we're sitting on our backsides waiting for somebody else to do something. And that's exactly the attitude of these people. They're grasping at straws. They're saying, oh, I hope the cavalry comes riding over the ridge. I hope the military takes over. I hope this happens. I hope this lawsuit takes effect. I hope all their hope, 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 hope. And here is the very thing about it. And that is because Americans have become intellectually lazy. And they have conditioned themselves that, hey, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to work at anything. I don't have to make sure my local people are constitutional, following the rules. I don't have to do anything because, oh, well, we got an election 2 years from now. We'll just get rid of them. Yeah, well, how's that worked out for you? Patriotism is one thing, but the point of it is liberty and freedom, the fire of liberty and freedom has to burn inside the individual. And when you get enough people who will have that desire for liberty and that desire for freedom to be their motivating factor when it comes to government or politics, then we have a chance. And we're never going to have a majority. If you're waiting for a majority, you're waiting on, they'll have FEMA camps ready for you at some point in time. So it's not, you're not going to have a majority, so don't wait for that. And somebody else is not going to do it for you. And that's what the political right in this country has been saying ever since the election. Well, I hope somebody does something. I hope this happens. I hope Q's right. I hope this person's right. I hope that person's right. That's all they've been saying. Terry, it's made me sad that the people do not have that burning fire for liberty and freedom. They have a fire to have their person in control. There's a big difference. We've lost that quest for liberty. We do not have the Patrick Henry. We do not have the Samuel Adams. We do not have the Luther Martins. We do not have the people that we should have, the Robert Yates, the John Lansing Juniors, the John Mercers. We don't have those people anymore. We don't have the people whose that fire for liberty burns inside of them and they work for it every day. People have been lulled into comfort. And it's like Emma Goldman said, Americans don't want to be free, they want to be comfortable. And right now, the right is getting uncomfortable and they don't like it and they want somebody to fix it. And true to the American spirit, they don't want to fix it themselves. They want somebody to do it for them. It ain't going to happen, people. And by no
the
means
suggestion,
am I advocating
the suggestion,
violence.
There's a suggestion that we get back to common law. And I've been having a conversation on chat here while you've been talking in that regard. And boy, the courts aren't going to allow that. So it's going to have to come from the people, from the grassroots, because that's the only place it can come from. The politicians don't understand it. The elected officials don't understand it. The bureaucracy hates it. But the bar gets the hair up on their back of their neck when you start talking about nullification, which is a common law principle that the people, in fact, have the final say over the law. And that's not understood or accepted in any bureaucratic environment, especially the judiciary. So,
well, and Terry, it was designed that way too.
Say again?
Because I said, look, people, you know, we go back to that ignorant of history thing. And, you know, Marcus Tullius Cicero said that a people who are ignorant of their own history will be forever children. Well, watch the children running around frantically now, hoping that a papa or a mama comes to help them. That's exactly what we have. We have a people who are ignorant of our history. Our Supreme Court redefined common law several years ago and said that common law is now, when the Supreme Court speaks of common law, it's a delusion. They're not talking about common law. They're talking about precedent.
Talking
so
about case
to
law.
Use words, yes. So they have said now if they make a reference, the Supreme Court makes a reference to common law, they're talking about stare decisis, what's already been decided. People,
well,
if
while
you know
we're
history,
talking about this, while we're talking about this, is it constitutional that the Supreme Court or any judge decides that they are the final arbiter of what is constitutional?
Oh, absolutely not. But that's the way it has evolved, and it has evolved that way. If you look at the history of the Supreme Court, Terry, prior to the law of Nolan Aggression, the Supreme Court was almost inactive. They did very little of anything. After the Civil War, the Supreme Court went nuts with rulings and legislation and everything else, and they became much more active. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison both said that if the final arbiter of what is and what is not constitutional is the Supreme Court, then we're ruled by an oligarchy. 9 unelected, politically well-connected people who serve for life and whose decisions cannot be appealed by anyone. Constitutional Convention. Luther Martin wrote the Supremacy Clause, and he defined the properties in that clause of the Supreme Court being that the Supreme Court could only rule in cases where the states differed in an opinion on a rule, that the Supreme Court had no other jurisdiction other than that. They could rule only on an argument between states. And that was the original that Luther Martin originally wrote. And in that, to put the power back in the hands of the people, Luther Martin said, okay, the Supreme Court will make the arguments even in those cases, but they will have a jury that will decide after they hear the Supreme Court argue. Think of that today. What, of course, today, the people, I wouldn't trust a jury today with these numbskulls anyway. But stop and think about if you would have had the Supreme Court argue a case and then have a jury of 12 or 18 people an odd number, you'd want an odd number. But if you had the people who said, okay, let's see who agrees with the Supreme Court and who didn't, who doesn't. You know, one of the things that I thought, and Luther Martin mentioned doing this, and so did George Mason, is that any decision of the Supreme Court would have to be approved by 3/4 of the states. But that was all written out by the Committee of Style. So why do you think that happened?
Oh, Mike, what's going through my mind right now is that there's a long list of political prisoners out there who started speaking publicly about the things that we're talking about right now as to the violations of Constitution and of common law, and as soon as they start drawing a crowd, they get charges, false charges, trumped up on them, and put, they're incarcerated, and in some cases, given psychotropic drugs and killed in prison. Others have been dieseled, what's called dieseling them, and have died from that. Lost limbs, even. We're in a situation now because of the length of time that we've been abdicating and not taking a stand. If we try to form committees of safety or what I call boards of review, similar to what happened in the Magna Carta, and start taking a stand at the grassroots level, which is what's required at this point, from in my view, the grassroots have got to raise up, and they've got to do it in a nonviolent way. They've got to, upstanding citizens in our communities and counties have got to begin to come together in a lawful manner. And in order to do that, it's like one said, we either hang together or we hang separately. And it's going to take courage. And we know that in the Revolutionary War, only 3% fought. We're in a little bit different situation right now than we were then, but it's not a whole lot different. In fact, we may be in worse situation now than we were then, but at least we've got other means of communication. We've got to start coming together at the grassroots and putting a stop to this lawfully, or we just proceed where we're headed, and that's not pretty. That's communism. We're going to see genocide. We're going to see our arms taken away, our means of defending ourselves taken away, if we do not quickly come together at the grassroots. How do we do that without being victims of this entire propaganda system? They propagandize people in movies and in series on television. These people have plotted out to create these movie production studios and take over our media the way that they have. They plotted it out over 100 years ago, and they have successfully subverted our federation. And they're going to continue to do that now that they have control of our federal government and most of our states, for that matter. Even those who in our states who we believe are conservatives or Republicans or whatever, many of them are in the establishment's pocket. And just as we've seen so many that we thought maybe, some people thought were conservatives in D.C. have now shown their true colors. Well, we're going to see the same thing in the states. And we are seeing the same thing in states. This whole plandemic is a perfect example of it. Why haven't we stood up to that? Because it's a lie. It's a fraud. It's a deliberately designed to crucify the middle class, small businesses, and the private business people. And it's doing a perfect job of it because people are abdicating it and they're letting it happen. We've got to stand up. How do we do that and not get persecuted by our federal government and state governments? We got to stand together. You can't do it individually, because if you do, they're gonna railroad you right into prison, or whatever they call these reconditioning camps or whatever. Mike, I know I've thrown this at you before, and it's a tough subject, but I'm hoping you've got some kind of, people need hope, Mike. I know that hope is a problem.
Re-education camps is what the socialists normally call them, and I think we've probably got those in our future. But you hit upon a very good point, Kerry, and this is, what if we don't have to load up our firearms and head out into the streets? And I believe this would send a very distinct message. What if 10% of this country's population, I believe they could make a difference. What if 10% of this country's population, 30 million people, picked a day and said, we're not wearing your damn mask. And they said, if we have, people, you got to, you've got to make some sacrifices. To wear a mask, I'm not going to work. If I have to wear a mask at work, I'm not wearing one. If I have to wear a mask to go in your business, I will not wear one. If you had 30 million people do that in one day and make it public, say, hey, we're going to pick out a day. We're going to pick out February the 14th, Valentine's Day, if that happens to be during the week. I have no clue, but I'm just giving an arbitrary day. What if we say we pick one day and 30 million people are going to make a pledge, I'm not wearing your damn mask? That is peaceful. That is not violent. But if they ever saw that there were that many numbers, that they had that kind of numbers opposing them, I believe we'd see at least a rethinking of where we're going. But we're not going to get anywhere as long as we keep complying with what they tell us. You know, I made it a point this morning to go to my post office because Biden signed the executive order yesterday, said you couldn't go on federal property without a mask. I made it a point to go to my post office and walk around inside. People say, well, what did that get you? Well, it didn't get me anything. Got me some attention. But I ain't wearing their damn mask. If you've got to stand up somewhere, and I would much rather have 30 million people in this country pick a day and say this is National No Mask Day. We're not wearing the damn thing. And that's a start. And that is a nonviolent start, Terry. That is a chance for the people to say, hey, look, we're tired of this crap. We're not waiting on the military to come riding over the hill. We're not waiting for military tribunals. We're not waiting on Q to do whatever it is he's been promising for 4 years. We're not doing that. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to take it upon ourselves, and we're not going to comply. Very peacefully, very simply, I'm not going to do that. That is the ultimate form of nullification, and it doesn't require violence. And I'm afraid if we don't do something like that, if we don't start showing these people that somebody is going to stand up and say no, because I'll promise you, until people stand up and say no, they're going to run over us like a steamroller. If we could get a number of people and a set date and say, no, we're not doing this, how can they deal with it if you had at least 10% of the people saying no? Do we have guts enough to do that? I don't think so. That would be my projection if somebody had the guts to do that and just say, you know, I don't care. I don't want to be redundant in it, but just say, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing what you're telling me to do, which is absolutely asinine. Because as long as you keep doing it, every time they come at you, it's going to be worse. You can either stand up or you can lay down and crawl. That's it.
Well, I'm out of words. Anything else I say could I don't want to bring black SUVs to my front door. So
I've had that. I've had that. And, you know, here's the thing. If I bring black SUVs to my door, by damn, I've done something to wake those bastards up. Pardon my French.
Well, we got about 16 more minutes to go here. And I'm not, I think we've just about said everything we need to say tonight. Is there anything else you want to contribute on 1871?
Well, there is one thing I would like to read, Terry. And this is, we're talking about Reconstruction. And we're talking about 1871. Let me read you from the floor of the U.S. Congress by a congressman from the state of Indiana by the name of Daniel Voorhees. Let me read and see if any of this resonates with you today. Here is what Representative Voorhees said on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. And he said, and I quote, "What right have you to expect peace and order in a land whose rulers are lawless felons? When did a bad government ever fail to produce wickedness and crime, to obey the laws when their officials do not? You expect them to love and reverence a government whose policy has made them bankrupt and miserable. Do you wonder that they became restless, desperate, and disobedient as they daily behold the fruit of their toil stolen from them in the name of government? Are you amazed at scenes of violence, outrage, bloodshed, and cruel vengeance when the executive of a state sets aside the entire administration of justice? Rather, you should be filled with astonishment at the forbearance and moderation you have witnessed. Had you sown the seeds of kindness and goodwill, they would long ere this have blossomed into prosperity and peace. Had you sown the seeds of honor, you would have reaped a golden harvest of contentment and obedience. Had you extended your charities and your justice to a distressed people, you would have awakened a grateful affection in return. But as you have planted in hate and nurtured in corruption, so have been the fruits which you have gathered, unquote.
You know, one of the things I loved about Red Beckman was that when he got confronted by the SPLC or some infiltrators that he identified, he took the opportunity to educate them. And it's like you said, you've done something to wake them up. But at this point, we've got to build relationships. That's another thing we've abdicated on. We haven't built the kind of relationships so that we can persuade people to do what's needed at this juncture. So there's nothing like starting today or tomorrow to get to know your neighbors and get to know upstanding citizens in your area and to begin to find commonality with them, because that's how positive change occurs. Very few people will make a positive change outside of the context of a relationship. 80%, 1 out of 10 make a change when they hear a truth. The 80%, 1 out of 10 never makes a change. But 80% will only make a positive change in the context of a relationship. Maybe you want to talk at this point a little bit about infiltration, Mike, because we know that probably if you've got 10 people together, you've got one infiltrator in your presence. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, that is definitely beyond a shadow of a doubt what's going to happen, because – and, you know, a lot of times those infiltrators are going to be your neighbors, you know, because they feel an allegiance to the government. It doesn't make any difference what the government does. Nazi Germany had it. The Soviet Union had it. You have the people who are going to stand up. People, if you're going to be driven by fear, you might as well give it up. Because are you going to fear yourself into allowing a government which is going to destroy the lives of your children and grandchildren? Because you weren't afraid to stand up? You know, it's not just what it's going to do to you. What's it going to do to our posterity? There are going to be infiltrators. I promise you there will be infiltrators. And I know because, you know, that when I talked about it, 2010, I wrote an article called Comfortable Patriotism. And it obviously bothered the FBI to the point that they thought they had to come visit with me and talk to me and find out why I was anti-government. And I said, I'm not anti-government, gentlemen. I'm anti-corrupt government. And I said, do you support a corrupt government? Is that what you signed on for? And, you know, and it kind of stopped them, because number one is they expect everybody to be scared shaky when they show up. And if you're not scared shaky, then they have to assume a different attitude. Of course, when you're standing there and there's four or five of them and there's one of you, they feel that power of numbers. That's one thing that I've always said, the cowards never send one person to talk to one person, because it doesn't have the illustration of power. But my article called Comfortable Patriotism. You know, and then suddenly, you know, the libertarian website that I was writing for at the time said, oh, we can't publish this because that's a clarion call for civil disobedience. Well, what the hell? What are we here for? We're never going to change this mess without civil disobedience.
But we can do it without violence. And yes, you're going to be infiltrated. I am sure you're going to be infiltrated. That is how you know you are doing it right. When you cause so much consternation in these sociopaths that they say, hey, we've got to send somebody to go figure out what they're doing. Just have your groups, talk to your groups, even if the people are there. Just never advocate violence. That is the thing. I think peacefully, when the people, if enough people in this country, again, not to be redundant, but if we could get, you know, 30 million people, 10% of the population, you get 30 million people to say, hey, we ain't doing this. Somebody's going to wake up, guys. If 10 people do it here, 14 well, over there, and nine somewhere else, you're never going to influence anything. You have to get enough people to make a difference, and enough people with enough cojones to love freedom so much that they're willing to step out there and do something.
How big is a grand jury?
Yeah. Well, it depends. You can have different numbers. It depends. Different states have different allocations. And, you know, sadly, some states have no provision for a grand jury, which I think is just absolutely.
What's the larger number?
Well, I was involved in a grand jury one time, had 24 people on.
That's a good number. I think that's a minimum number for a group. How many you got to really have together in your community.
Well, the problem is, Terry, with this wonderful public fool system that we've had in effect for so long, and that's the thing that's killing us, because we have people now who weren't educated, who weren't taught anything. We've got the law schools in America are the bastions of Marxism and have been for the last 30 to 40 years. Have you ever found a conservative lawyer? That's about as rare as a diamond in a pig's butt. It just doesn't happen. You just don't, because they have been taught socialism. So how in the world do you ever think you're going to get a true conservative judge when they're taught Marxist principles? And they know nothing about the founding. I think you and I have proved that on a couple of occasions, haven't we, Terry?
I believe so.
And around attorneys in Arkansas for the better part of 2 years. I talked with several of them, and I would say, okay, how much of the actual drafting of the Constitution and the dynamics of the Constitution were you taught in law school? And usually it's 3 to 4 hours max. Well, I can talk 3 to 4 hours about one individual. Give me Luther Martin. I can talk to people about him for 3 to 4 hours. And Luther Martin was the attorney general for the state of Maryland for almost 27 years. Probably the brightest legal mind in America at the time. I think he was. Patrick Henry was fantastic, but his was in his presentation. Luther Martin knew law. I mean, just absolutely new law. And he left if you've got an attorney general who at that time, who was probably the best lawyer in the country, walked off of the Constitutional Convention because he said it just wasn't right what they were doing. Why isn't that taught in today's world? And of course, you and I both know, Terry, I brought up Luther Martin to an accomplished attorney of 30 some years, and he didn't even know who Luther Martin was.
The internet is a data farm, particularly anybody that's using Google. It is a data farm. It gives up your IP address. So first thing I want to urge people to do is to stop using Google. You can get to Google by going to DuckDuckGo or to StartPage. You can also use VPNs, variable protocol networks, that does not give up your IP address as well on searches. But we need to figure out ways to stop giving up our search information to those who are monitoring it, because it is a data farm. So stop using Google, people. Virtual private network, someone just sent me a note on. VPN, it basically does not give up your accurate IP address if you're using a VPN. I know Opera, I think, is one of those. There's several others out there. But Google is a part of the data farm. And I can tell you that the FBI was responsible for putting Facebook into play. They took the LifeLog program from the Pentagon, and the day it terminated, Facebook was launched. So the idiot that claims to be the head of Facebook did not create Facebook, nor did any of his own people. It was handed to him by the government in order to be a data farm to find out what people were doing, what they were saying, and to basically build a barcode for everyone in the cloud so that they could manage everyone on the planet digitally. And now they've got 5G they're putting into place, which is very harmful. The symptoms of 5G for anyone that's radio sensitive are the same as the symptoms of COVID. So wake up, people. We're in a surveillance state. So be careful with your searches. Don't go directly to Google. Go to some other search engine that will not give up your IP, your location. I could say so much more, Mike, but I don't want to tie it up. What's your closing thoughts here, Mike? We got 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, Terry, again, and if I say this, it's just going to be reiterating what I've said before. But if the fire of freedom for your posterity, if we think down the road and think about, you know, how terrible things are right now, how terrible do you think they're going to be after, Joe Biden may be president for 3 to 4 months, and then I think the busy beaver is going to take over after him. And imagine what it's going to be like for these people. What are these people saying? You know, what have they been saying? And if you do not have fire in your belly for freedom and liberty for your posterity, as Samuel Adams said, hey, just get out of our way, because you're only going to hurt the cause. And if you don't have, here's the thing, if people do not have the courage to tell someone, I'm not wearing a damn mask, if you don't have the courage to tell someone that, you're never going to have freedom. It's not going to happen. You've been conditioned. You've been put in the pot, and they turned up the heat slowly and gradually, and we're about to boil alive. We have an option. You can say no. The people who can't say no are slaves, by the very simple definition of the word. Are you content with your, when you look at your grandchildren, are you content, or your children, to say, hey, it's going to be fine. You know, imagine this. And this really prompted me years ago. And I've told very few people about this, but years ago, decades ago, I had this dream one night about I'm in my resting place, final resting place in the ground. There's a headstone over my head, and then my grandchildren are standing around my grave in chains. And they said, Grandpa, why didn't you do something? Well, I try to do something every day. Not trying to be melodramatic, but I try to do something every day so that that won't happen. 29,999,999 people to join me. But that's something I'm going to do, and I'm going to continue to do it every day. That's about all I have to say, Terry.
Well, it's been a good program. I hope people take to heart some of the things we've shared. Thanks for bringing us to some level of sensibility about 1871. Mike, you always go to source documents, and I I really appreciate that a lot. I really do. It kind of cuts to the chase. When people hear the source documents, it's hard to dispute it. I wish more history professors and teachers would do that. I think we can wrap this one up, Mike. I think it's a wrap for this week. We're going to be back next Thursday night, Mike, if they don't come and get us. Hopefully they won't. I just want to urge people to pray. We know who the ultimate victor is in this battle. It is a spiritual battle. We're fighting evil here. We're not fighting a party, because you're going to find that evil in all the parties. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, always remember, Terry, you catch more flack when you're over the target.
Amen, brother. Good night, everyone. Thank you for listening. Appreciate you joining us.
Hey, thanks, everyone. Have a great one.
Have a good night. Have a good night, brother. Good night.
You too.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to rise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly into the light of a dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly into the light of the dark black night. Well, blackbird singing in the dead of night. Won't you take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. Only waiting for this moment to be free. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. You were only waiting for this moment to be free.